This is not war. It's human extinction.
Welcome to episode 20 of Popcorn Prosecco, 30 minutes of nonstop movie talk. This week, we are talking about Snowpiercer, Begin Again, and Transformers, Age of Extinction. So we are kicking things off, though, with Snowpiercer. Christy, you've got that one.
Hi, guys. So Christy Petchko here from CinemaBlend. We're going to talk about Snowpiercer, which is the latest from Bong Joon-ho. It's actually his English language debut. And it's got an incredible cast that includes Chris Evans and Tilda Swinton and Jamie Bell and John Hurt and just everyone is in this movie. Octavia Spencer, Ewan Brenner, there's tons of people. It's basically about this train called Snowpiercer that's zipping through the world that has been completely ice-aged, and everything is dead on the earth except what's on this train. So, unfortunately, having humanity greatly reduced hasn't made us any more good at being a community, so the poors are in the back of the train, and everybody else who has super tons of money is at the front of the train. And
yes.
While the front of the train
there's
is like...
There's no middle class in this movie. There's like nobody in
the middle. I have a suspicion about that, because they say something about economy class, so I think the people that are working and doing the bidding of Wilford are economy class. But Wilford is... Yeah, because they say something about like, oh, I knew her, she was a maid or something. So like, there's people who are like... working, I'm guessing, for like mid-ranking accommodations, or maybe the soldiers or whatever.
I feel like the soldiers would probably be the closest thing that qualifies to middle class. But yeah,
it's not what one might expect of a middle class person, really.
Yeah. But this was another movie that made me be like, humanity had a good run, and we can just stop now.
It's kind of a good summer for movies of just being like, we're done.
I've seen so many movies this year that makes me be like, you know, if the world ended and all of humanity died out, I don't know that it'd be such a huge loss.
But in
especially
this movie,
if the Moodles took over. But anyway, continue.
In this movie, we're following Chris Evans as Curtis Everett. And he's in the tail end section, and he wants to plan a rebellion where he wants to get the whole way to the front of the train from the back of the train, because the people on the back of the train, they're starving, they're dirty, they're crowded, and he's heard such great stories about the front of the train. He wants that wealth to be spread around a little bit. So he has to get to Wilford, who is said to be at the front of the train. And along the way, there's a lot of fighting, and there's a lot of discoveries, and there's a lot of crazy scenes, and there's a lot of Tilda Swinton. She's my girl. That's the kind of Snowpiercer in a nutshell. I love this movie, and last week we talked about the best movies of 2014, and we made a self-imposed rule that we were only going to talk about movies that were already out, so I chose not to talk about Snowpiercer. But this week we get to talk about Snowpiercer.
This would have been in my top, definitely.
Mine too, yeah.
Talk about it last week. This movie is freaking incredible. This blows my mind. There are so many unbelievable set pieces in this movie, and that makes it into one. Like, I've actually seen this movie twice. I went to two screenings of it because I had to see it again. But it's one of those movies where all the set pieces are so good, you always have something to look forward to, which is what makes it so rewatchable, and that's great in one of the best movies.
I also saw it twice, and what I thought was really cool the second time was, one, knowing how it was going to end, I kind of watched the cues along the way, and it made a lot of sense to me. Two, the set design is so smart that, like, you can pick up all these things from the world from it. Like, it's such telling set design, so that I completely loved.
Yeah, it's another really well-designed set where it adds a lot of texture to the world and tells you everything you need to know about, like, the kind of people we're dealing with and, like, the kind of world we're living in. And the one thing I liked about this movie is that it felt really dark and gritty in a way that felt earned, because I feel like the word gritty has become this, like, catch-all phrase for, like, we're kind of like The Dark Knight. And, like, a lot of times I'll be like, okay, everything's kind of grimy looking and there's a lot of, like, angry, frowny people, but it's not actually, like, dark. Like, it's not actually, like, you know, edgy, or it's not actually challenging you in any way. This movie, I felt like, was dark and gritty in a way that it was like, okay, you came by that honestly. First of all,
and
it's,
you
like,
know, it's funny, it doesn't always, it's literally dark, gritty, and very dirty at points, but then you get other scenes, like the one with Alison Pill, where it's like all these incredibly vibrant colors, and, you know, it really switches up things nicely, and it keeps everything fresh, because you walk into that classroom set, and it's like, holy shit, look at all this, and it's so, it's amazing to me how different each train car was, but how it all felt so cohesive and played together with such a natural flow.
It works because you're kind of like, you know, Chris Evans is a protagonist, and we're basically following him through the train, and you have the same reaction he does when he walks out into this part of the train he's never seen, that's like, you know, really rich and like filled with light and beautiful, and he's just like, like really disoriented and just like, what is this?
That's actually,
and it feels like really like sinister when you see it, even though if you saw it in a different context, you might just be like, oh, it's really cute and colorful.
Well, especially because in the classroom scene, we get a lot of background on like how the train came about and also how the people in the front class think of the people in the back of the class because of propaganda. And there's a really amazing still from the film that maybe we should put, we'll put in here somewhere. But it's a still of the children doing this like thing like this, and like Tilda Swinton's doing it too in the still, and it's like, which is actually inaccurate to the movie, but we don't need to get into why. But it's like the still where like everyone who's wealthy in the scene is like, and then the two people who are not wealthy and are from the tail are like, and it encapsulates the class disparity of this world so perfectly, because all these kids are clean and brightly colored and think they're the best, and Wilford's the best, and they do, like, they get what they get because not because of privilege, but because they deserve it. And the people in the back are dirty, is what they tell them to their faces. And you're just like, oh, shit. Like,
yeah, even though it's an exaggerated world, it really, like, when you see things like that, you're like, oh, okay, this is a movie that really gets how people work, and not just the nice parts about how sometimes we're, like, heroic and courageous and put others in front of ourselves, but, like, the parts of us that kind of justify horrible things.
Absolutely. I just think that Snowpiercer is one of those movies that gets richer every time you watch it, and then the performances are outstanding. Especially what's cool is he has two people from his first from the first movie we know about from Bong Joon-ho, The Host, which, and pardon me if I don't get their names correct, there's Song Kang-ho and Ko Ah-sung, and they were the father and the daughter in The Host, and now they're back playing another father and daughter, which is kind of awesome, but kind of sad because they're in a dystopian world where they are junkies. But they're wonderful in it, and what's cool about it is, like, she speaks a little bit of English, he doesn't speak any, but because of the sci-fi nature of it, they're like, oh, here's this device that'll translate. So he can speak Korean, and it's fine, because the movie will do the work for us. But, like, he can perform in the language in which he's comfortable, and I think it helps the performance.
Another major highlight of those characters, too, is that within this dark, gritty environment where people die, they're the source of humor. And it's not just a humor that's there for the sake of getting a laugh at whatever moment the director pleases. It has a payoff in the end, and it makes a lot of sense. But going back to something you guys both brought up before, that the experience gets richer and richer every single time, I think we need to point out that because that happens the first time through, certain things might not come together as well as maybe they should. Like, just for example, the assassin-type character, I forget what his name is now.
Yeah, I don't remember.
It's something, I read up on it now, so it's something the elder and something the younger. I forget their name.
But they're basically like two gangsters that are going after the lower class.
The first time I saw Snowpiercer, I had a big problem with him, the elder one, because he turns out to be one of the chief villains in this movie, where at first you think he's just out to, you know, maintain order in the train and follow his own orders, but then all of a sudden he just is, like, hell-bent on killing these people, and he's going to destroy the train if he has to, he's going to kill civilians if he has to, it doesn't matter. And you don't really ever understand why, or at least the first time I watched it, I didn't pick up on why. Then I went home and I start writing my review, and then I finish my review, I'm Googling around for the answer, and there it is, I see the answer. And then when I went to see it again, there's this beautiful shot that kind of explains why he's so pissed, and then it works, but the first time it doesn't work. But still, even with deficiencies like that, the movie is so strong in so many other respects that that's not going to bog you down at all.
I also want to point something out, because this keeps happening when I write about this movie, that someone in the post inevitably will be like, I already streamed it, and it's not that good. Here's the thing. First off, don't brag about being a pirate on the internet. It doesn't make you cool. It just makes you the asshole that wouldn't pay for something. Two, and this is my bigger point, if you're watching this on your computer, you're missing out. It is a movie that is meant to be seen in the theater. The sound effects, the darkness of it, it pulls you in. You need to be, like, clustered together. And it's also something, like, because theaters are normally really cold, it adds to the environment of this chilly scenario. Like, I don't want to, I'm tired of hearing people say they watched it on the internet and were unimpressed. I'm unimpressed by you.
I agree, but I would say that.
And then have a comment.
I agree, and I think that that goes for a lot of movies and not just Snowpiercer. But the other thing, like, you know, we're talking about how smart this movie is and how well designed and how well acted. It's also just really, really fun. Like, there's a lot of, like, really entertaining action sequences, and there's it has more of a sense of humor than you would think for how dark this movie is. Tilda Swinton is a source of, Tilda Swinton in this is amazing.
Holy shit, Tilda Swinton.
This year. She's, like, not, I could not tell you that she's, like, the same person, like, if I didn't know that Tilda Swinton was credited in all these movies, I don't honestly know if I would always know that it was her.
It's like, really incredible how well known she is and how she's still able to lose herself in a character, because there's a lot of really talented actors out there, but when they're in a certain amount of movies, like, let's just say Tom Cruise in Edge of Tomorrow, I still think he's a really good actor, but I
You'd
still look at
Tom
him,
Cruise.
I see Tom Cruise.
Yes. Tilda Swinton disappears into this character. And, like,
and
you know, a lot of
disturbing.
Yeah, a lot of it is costuming, but she's really funny, but also, like, genuinely terrifying.
Yeah, she's really, and it's funny because she's terrifying and she's funny. Like I said in my review on Cinema Blend, she's a criticism of this classist ideology in that she believes it devotedly and she herself is a ridiculous character. Oh, and one more thing before we move on, because we're going to need to get everything in today. I just want to say, what I also think is really interesting is a lot of the violence in this movie technically happens off camera, but it doesn't negatively impact the impact of the violence. This movie still feels incredibly brutal,
yes.
And in the way that it should. It is showing you brutality so that you understand it as brutality. It's not garish. It's not like slasher or exploitation. It wants you to feel.
Well, that's one of the things that I was talking about when I was talking about earlier how it comes by its darkness and its grittiness. Honestly, this is a movie where the violence is, like, it's fun to watch because it's still a movie and it's shot really well, but it's also viscerally upsetting. Like, this is a movie where when, like, the hero, you know, hurts another person, you really feel, like, horrible about
well,
it.
Well, it's because that's a testament to how good Chris Evans is in this movie, because
him and
he's like a really stoic leader, and you believe that he's tough enough to get these people from the back of the train to the front of the train, but then things happen, and just, like, ever so slightly, he'll let the slightest bit of emotion creep out, or they'll hold on one reaction shot, and it lets you know that these people still feel something, and that turns it into much more than violence. It gives the violence weight.
Yeah, exactly. It's like there's a scene, I won't get into it, but you guys know what I mean, the scene with Jamie Bell and Chris Evans, and it's a gutting scene. It's the impact of violence there is really felt, and it's like this movie is really well done. I'm nervous because the Weinsteins are giving it a limited release, and they don't appear to be promoting it much, so I feel like we may not get another Bong Joon-ho movie in English.
That was a whole thing that you can look up on the internet if you're interested.
It's depressing as shit. But here's the good news. Bong Joon-ho is an amazing filmmaker. He will continue to make movies, though maybe not in America, and I'm going to follow him anywhere, because the movies he makes are outstanding.
Yes. Can I just say, Zach just made a popcorn and Prosecco cameo, and I
did. Well, not all of him, just his arm. It was very strange.
It was wonderful. Good job, Zach.
You guys have cats. I have my husband prowling around while we record.
He's very cat-like, so it works.
He is.
Seriously, that's like a move Roger or Dewey might make.
Yeah, Roger, I feel like as far as people go, Zach is fairly feline. And I feel like he would take that as a compliment.
You came into frame, and now you're in discussion.
All right.
I'm not going
to
say anything else. Let's move on.
All right. Our next movie, clearly, by the way, we want you to see Snowpiercer. Not that that needed to be repeated, I guess. But now we're going to talk about the movie Begin Again. And this thing stars Mark Ruffalo and Keira Knightley. Mark Ruffalo is a former hotshot music executive producer type guy. He gets a string of bad clients. He becomes like a heavy drinker, he has a bad relationship with his wife, he kind of looks like a homeless man, and he's the blackest feet I've ever seen in my life. And then there's Keira Knightley, who is dating Adam Levine's character. Just so you know, I spoke to Mark Ruffalo this morning, and we talked at length about his dirty feet. And then there's Keira Knightley's character. She's dating Adam Levine, and the two of them are kind of like a team. She writes the songs and he sings them, but then they come to the States when his career is taking off and no one's really noticing her. He becomes a hotshot himself, sleeps with somebody else, and she breaks up with him. And now she's like all alone in the big city and doesn't know what to do. Anyway, the two of them come together because she participates in an open mic, and he's like, oh my god, you're going to revitalize my career. I need to sign you now, but I can't really sign you because I don't work anywhere. Anyway, the two of them come together, and I don't want to spoil the movie.
Magic and music.
It's pretty predictable, especially when you describe it that way. But even though it's predictable, I liked this movie. It never slowed for me. I enjoyed it all, and really, it's just simple, happy, predictable, but inspiring. It just made me feel good. Nothing special about it. I don't think we need to praise it all that much, but, you know, if you want to see something that's going to make you smile, go see it.
Well, if you were going to give it a letter grade, Perry, what would you give it? Because I'm getting from you, like, it's not that bad. I mean, it's not that good, but it's not that bad.
I'd say, like, a B-rated happy movie. You know what I mean?
If this were a food, what would it be? I know that sounds dumb, but bear with me. Because my thought process is...
you know what? If this was a food, I feel like it would be... like a brand ice cream. You know when, like, you go to a brand versus, like, a real creamery when they make something good and it's, like, filled with chemicals?
I got you. You're like, this is satisfying and pleasing, but it's not something I will tell other people I've
eaten.
It's not,
like, quality,
you
know?
Instagram this. Yeah, no, I got you.
Yeah, in Instagram food terms, you would not Instagram this. You would keep it for yourself. It's a guilty pleasure.
That might be hungry. It's kind of disappointing because, you know, like the first one, that would be like the artisanal ice cream that's only made from like local ingredients that they only have in Brooklyn, like that kind of thing.
I'm
sorry, I'm talking about
that
once.
That puts it all in
Brooklyn. Previous
and that's
movie.
The thing. Yeah. That's why, like, Begin Again is fine. It's fine. It's inoffensive, it's sweet, its plot kind of makes sense, and the characters are nice. But, like, I just don't have any passion behind this movie, and from the maker of Once, that is infuriating. Like, Once was a dingy-looking movie, because it was when digital didn't look good yet, it had people who weren't stars in it, but they had this connection on screen that you just couldn't deny, and you wanted to be a part of their world, and you wanted to curl up in that soundtrack. I can't remember a single song from Can a Song Save Your Life, or Begin Again, or whatever they're calling it now. Like, it's just not interesting to me. Adam Levine is a convincing douchebag, but the music he sings in that movie is instantly forgettable.
Okay, you know what, though? You know the one movie... Now, of course, I can't remember what the tune was, the words or anything, but I did walk out of the movie. It might be because it was the last song played in the movie, but singing the last song that he gets up on stage and sings, and like...
But that's supposed to be the bad version of the song.
No, it's supposed to be the good version of the song. The song, the version she wants, no?
No, I think he plays the version he wants, and that's why she... We're getting into spoilers.
I don't know.
I that's the thing. The music in this movie is fine, but it's not so good that, like, I don't need direction from the characters to tell me if this is a good or a bad song. I'm like, this is fine. And the character's like, this is terrific. And I'm like, oh, okay, it's terrific. And this, like, in Once, the music is outstanding, and I don't need anyone to tell me that because I feel it, and it's heartbreaking, and it's genuine. But in this, it's a New York movie that feels like a tourist movie. They're like, oh, look, we're shooting in New York, but it doesn't feel like New York, especially because, like, one concept of the movie is that they're recording an album on the streets of New York. So it's a live album on the streets of New York, which anybody who lives in New York is like, oh, that's adorable. That would never work ever, and it wouldn't. And
well,
it's
okay.
I love your reaction to that, because if I came across someone being like, we're recording, I'd be like, no, fuck you.
It's a terrible idea, yeah.
From beginning to end, every single time they shot somewhere, not shot somewhere, sung somewhere, I was always like, you know, and you know, actually the producer, my producer brain was going off when, like, especially when they're singing on the roof, I'm like, how'd they get permission to do that? Like, do you need a permit? Shouldn't they have called someone?
Well, also stuff that I was like, if you're, like, recording on a rooftop, how are there not sirens in the background of every track?
Because where are they pulling their electricity from half the time, too? Mm-hmm.
And see, that's the thing. I know this is stuff we're not supposed to think about, but it's like, it just felt really dishonest. It was just like, you're trying to write a movie about New York, but it doesn't feel like you understand New York. Because, like, the first movie, I've never been to the town they are in Ireland. I have been to Ireland, but I haven't been to that town. But it felt like we all understood that town. And, like, when you go to New York, you can't quite fake it the same way, because a lot of people have been to New York or know New York. And so, like, it just felt really dishonest to be like, oh, we're going to make this gritty music, and I'm not going to get into it, but the final thing about how they promote this album just undercuts the whole noble intentions.
I'll give you that. That was a very unsatisfying and, like, even deflating way for all of that to have ended up. I get the noble intentions, but it did not come across that way, and it's so illogical. After you put all that time and energy, that's what you do with it.
Like, I feel like it's making it sound like I hated this movie, and I don't. I just, like, I don't care about this movie, and that's really frustrating to me because I loved Once so much. So my problem is more that Begin Again is fine. It's like a sweet movie that people can go to. It's, you know, yeah, it's like a sorbet. You're like, oh, that was nice. Excellent.
Shut your mouth. I love sorbet. There is really good sorbet out there.
It's delightful. It is not going to satisfy me as a dessert.
I don't want to turn this... Baskin-Robbins sorbet versus sorbet made from real fruit.
Okay, I'm with Perry.
I can't stop talking about ice cream.
I really want ice cream now.
Let's just get through this.
Talk from Prosecco problems. There's our hashtag.
But I mean, like, it's fine. It's just that, like, my problem with this movie is it feels like Hollywood went to the guy from Once and said, "Now make us a Hollywood version." And
that's
I don't want a Hollywood version.
You know, you don't like the Hollywood version as much as Once, but like the Hollywood version of almost anything works, you know, just a little bit.
Sure.
There's certain things that work every time you do it, and that's what happens here. And when, you know, the story ends up where it ends up, like, I'm trying to think of, like, a specific moment. Like, when Haley Steinfeld picks up the guitar, it's like that whole story element didn't work at all because it was funny when the mother was like, you know, she sucks at the guitar. Like, that would have been kind of funny, but then all of a sudden she turns out to be some, like, miraculous soloist. That's such bullshit.
And that's the thing, there's not a whole lot of obstacles in this movie. Like, he's like, I've lost my job. Then he's like, oh, I found this great girl. Then he just storms back into his job and goes, I got this girl. Like, there's no stakes. It's just like, and like, her, like, big stake is like, well, if this doesn't work, I guess I'll go back to my family. Like, okay. But like, she doesn't seem to like New York anyway, so who cares?
Yeah. Her ending was a little...
I like James Corbin in this.
For me. Yeah.
He's the roommate, and he's going to have a huge role in Into the Woods this winter, so I'm excited about that.
I liked his whole part of the playing outside thing, too. It's like what everyone else was doing. I was always watching him, I guess because I was so fascinated with how it all worked, and he was in charge of making it work, that my eye was always drawn to him and what he was kind of like doing in the corner.
I think that's true. And the other thing that we learn from this movie is that there is no alley in New York where children are playing where those children don't know how to sing.
Oh my God, that part. That part got me. That makes me sound like a simple asshole. No, but that one moment was like cheese to the max where like everyone is giggling at it, not with it, because really that's not going to happen.
Also, they would get sued to pieces when their parents found out, like, wait, what do you mean we recorded my kids? Like, it's not like you saw them go, oh, and sign these waivers, children, thanks. Like, it's New York, we're a very litigious city, you can't just do shit like that.
Yeah, really. I mean, really, you know, when you're making a movie in New York, you can't put a single thing on the ground without getting a permit. Look what they put on the ground in this movie. There's no cops, really. There's one little apartment building. Like, someone yells at them?
Someone yells at them from a window. It's like, hey!
There were no cops, though.
Yeah.
All right, so let's wrap this one up. What do you think, Christy? It's silly, but is it worth seeing?
I mean, like, I wouldn't pay to see this again. I'd probably give it a C. It's fine. It's totally fine. Harsh. But my thing is, there are such better movies in theaters right now. Like, when it comes to VOD, if you want something that's the equivalent of, you know, Breyers chocolate or something, fine. But, like,
Breyers is good.
It's fine. It's totally fine. But, like, I want something more from movies. It also annoys me because Weinstein Company is opening this against Snowpiercer, and Begin Again is getting all this attention, and Snowpiercer is getting ignored. It's screwed up. Maybe that's why I'm a little intense about this, but, like, Begin Again is fine. It's totally fine. I wouldn't recommend anyone see it because your life is not going to be any different for seeing this movie.
That's freaking crazy. Why is Weinstein opening two of their movies against each other?
Because they don't really want Snowpiercer.
I mean, they don't cross over whatsoever, but still, that's crazy. Anyway, I mean, obviously see Snowpiercer, but I would still recommend this if you're... It's because, like, you know, you always want the best movie you possibly can get. A movie that's thoughtful, it makes you think, makes you engaged, but, you know, every now and then, you gotta just sit back, relax, and be happy, and have, like, a simple, you know, no-nonsense, put-a-smile-on-my-face experience, and that's what this is. If that's what you want to see... This is going to satisfy that, so go do it.
So, speaking of simple, no-nonsense experiences, let's talk about Transformers: Age of Extinction! That was obviously sarcastic. It is ridiculously complicated, and there is a
which
shit ton of
which is why Andy
I dare you to explain this plot. I dare you.
I'm not
I dare you to
try.
Even recall, like, a handful of the names of, like, if, the characters in play.
If
here.
Any of you watching nope. are new to our podcast, Angie somehow always manages to pick the movie that's plot line is impossible to describe.
I will be completely honest. I'm not even going to try to explain all the intricacies of this plot, because I think, you know what? I'll be real. I don't understand it myself. But basically, so, okay, let me attempt. So this is a sequel, but, you know, basically a reboot of the Transformers franchise. So all the robots are the same, but now they have new human friends. So the main new human friend is Mark Wahlberg, who plays Cade Yeager, and he's an inventor, and he's like a terrible inventor who never has any money, and he somehow ends up acquiring this like really dusty, shitty looking truck that he's gonna sell for parts. But then, you know, he like starts poking around, and he's like, "Holy shit, you guys! I think I found a Transformer," and I think that might actually be verbatim, except for maybe the shit part, because that's the kind of dialogue. This
no, it's literally
has.
Like this. It's like, guys, I think I found a Transformer.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was my Mark Wahlberg. You're welcome.
And oh, everyone, take a shot. Christy did an impression.
It wasn't good, but it was there.
Anyway, so he has a daughter, Nicola Peltz, Tessa.
Ugh.
See, I do know her name.
So bad.
Who is, you know, basically the Megan Fox. She's like the hot young thing that they all think is super hot. And okay, so in this. I'm already getting tripped up.
Where do you, but like, seriously, where do you even start? It's they get pulled into the battle, but who's the bad guy here?
Okay, so no, I think I'm never even explain that. I'm going to try again. Yeah. All right, so when this movie picks up, the things that happened in the last Transformers movies happened a few years ago, and now humanity has turned against Transformers, and they've decided all Transformers are bad. Autobots, Decepticons, the whole lot of them are horrible. And Kelsey Grammer is, like, the leader of... He's part of the government, part of the CIA, I think, and he's, like, the leader of thinking Transformers are bad and wanting to, like, get rid of them. But he has his own ulterior motives. Meanwhile, there is also... Stanley Tucci plays like a
Steve Jobs.
He plays like a Steve Jobs or like Tony Stark type guy. And his thing is like his company has figured out that Transformers are made out of, get this, Transformium. There's an element called Transformium. And
I told that to my husband this morning and he mimed slitting his own wrists. That was his response to this development.
Yeah. And his computers and his company wants to figure out how to like use Transformer technology to like revolutionize the world and make shit tons of money. Okay, so those are the three main plot threads we have going on.
No, then there's the aliens who come in.
There's the evil, not Decepticon, but other robots who they never really explain who
they
are.
Do they name them? I don't think they ever name them.
All right, no,
they're like Transformers with like faces, you know.
We need to just move on at this point because the thing is like we've only got so much time. But the movie basically has a million working pieces, which is a lot like the first three. But the problem is that like who cares? Like it's why are these plots so convoluted? If people want to go see robots fight, just make robots fight.
Well, that's my problem with this movie. Okay, so first of all, my biggest problem with this movie is that it's 3 hours long. But in my mind, that's also its main selling point, because if you're going just for the AC, then you get to sit in cool air for 3 hours, which is kind of nice.
Who is it that tweeted, sitting through this twice is like a whole work day?
Because
that
means
because you know, we go and we see these movies for work, but really, when you think about it, if we had sat through it twice, it would have been like a full working day.
It was so long.
2 hours and 45 minutes long, and honestly, if it was 50% shorter, I would have liked it 50% more. I'm not kidding.
I would say 2 hours of this movie is like robot-on-robot nonsense that you can barely like make out the environment or how everything is actually moving and coming together. And then I want to say another half hour of it is probably sunset moments. And then the other 15
minutes... The entire movie takes place at dusk. It doesn't make any sense. Like,
it's always magic hour in a Michael Bay movie.
Anything that's not like a massive action sequence, you know, involving like eight different gigantic robots, it's dusk. I don't know how. Totally. I don't know why.
But here's the craziest thing. It's just that because there are so many plot threads, there are scenes in this movie that have nothing to do with anything. Like, and I freaked out about this on Twitter today because I'm just like, that was a real thing that happened. There is a scene explaining the statutory rape laws of Texas.
Okay, so what happens is Mark Wahlberg's daughter is 17, and she is secretly dating this guy who is 20, and, you know, Mark Wahlberg doesn't find this out until they're already, like, on the run because the government is after them because they found a transformer. And then the whole movie kind of, like, grinds to a halt so that the dad and the boyfriend can have a conversation about how it's not really rape because she's 17 and Texas has Romeo and Juliet laws and they're, like, close enough in age that he wouldn't actually get thrown in jail. And besides, it's okay because they're right next to the same
time. There's
a
rape scene in the movie. There's not. This isn't Maleficent. It's just that there's a scene where he says, like, Mark Wahlberg basically threatens him and says, I'm going to call the cops. You're not allowed to be with her because you're too old. And he's like, actually, we've been dating since I was in high school.
Can I say my favorite part of that scene, though, is that it ends with Jack Rayner, who plays the boyfriend, pulling out a laminated card that he apparently just carries around in his wallet at all times, which has, like, the statute, like, the Texas, like, statutory rape law, like, printed on it. And it makes you think, like, whoa, what kind of life are you leading that this is just something you need to carry around in your wallet all the time? Like, how many girls are you, like, almost but not quite statutory raping in your life? It's so weird.
Or also, nothing would have made that better, but the problem with those two was just that their relationship sucked and the characters
so boring.
Sucked. You didn't want them to be together. Like, at one point, I forget if this is the exact line he used, but I was dying when the kid character turned to Mark Wahlberg and said, what did he say? Like, I'm not going in to save your daughter. You're going in to save my girlfriend.
Yeah. Tessa's not even a person. She is a possession that they are fighting over. It's just one long kissing contest between these two.
Boyfriend is also barely a person. There are really no people or characters in this movie, which is kind of
like that Darcy character. She has no point. There's some random Chinese woman that appears halfway through the movie. Darcy's the blonde that's like,
she's a scientist.
Oh, the opening scene.
Yeah, yeah. She's like
coworker. Yells at Stanley Tucci later.
When she said that. She just walks around in white outfits all day to make up for the loss. Wasn't it Megan Fox who ran around Transformers 2 in that white outfit that never got dirty?
What's her face? Whitley in Transformers 3. Like, it's Michael Bay's thing. He likes women in with big boobs wearing white clothing.
Clothing might be Michael Bay's thing, the way, like, a foot fetish is Quentin Tarantino's thing. It's just, like, a thing that's just disturbing. In all of his movies because it, like, excites him for some reason.
No, that's totes right. That's
There are weirder, more fucked up fetishes than low angle, looking
up at everybody.
How many times we've looked at Nicole Peltz's legs and ass? It's really uncomfortable because, like, just a couple of years ago, she was in The Last Airbender. Like, I still remember her with the little, like, you know, running around and being like, Aang! Because they said his name wrong.
I don't know about her. Like, I don't know if it was just Michael Bay or the way this was written, but, like, she just was not good. It's like Mark Wahlberg's character wasn't particularly well written and there was nothing that great about him, but he still, like, brought a unique sense of, like, life
Mark Wahlberg is saying stuff like, I know you have a conscience because, like me, you're an inventor. Like, we're like, oh, I like you, Mark Wahlberg. It's fine that you're saying nonsense.
Yes, because inventors have never invented anything that has ever done anything bad to this world, ever.
There's so many things where a character will state something and then do completely the opposite. Like, at one point, Optimus Prime threatens another Transformer and says, like, I've freed you, and now you can choose to fight with me, or I'll kill you. And I was like, that's not freedom.
Yeah, that's
really a spoiler. You know that Optimus Prime comes together with the Dinobots, but, like, he literally just, like, has a fight with them, mounts him, and is like, you are mine now.
It made me feel really bad for the Dinobots, because up until this point, the fight has nothing to do with them. They have no skin in the game.
They were captured on the spaceship.
I get that, but, like, you don't really see them, do you? I mean, and, like, what's the deal with that little creature that gets shot? Because I saw him in the cage.
Are you talking about the really tiny Transformer?
Like the creature that what's his face? The guy with the tank stuff, he walks in there and he's like, you're annoying, and he just shoots it.
Yeah, he calls.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the king calls so, like, the disgusting and just shoots it.
Yeah,
for some reason,
Dinobots have been in like that structure, but I never really saw them. So to me, it's like they just kind of came out of the earth and were miraculously there.
No, totally. And I feel like Michael Bay normally has a good sense of geography in his action movies, but in this, the geography is a total clusterfuck, and I can't follow where people are or what's going on. And so yeah, it's just like, oh, I guess we're in a different part of the spaceship because everything looks the same, but they told us we're in a different part. Like, it's not a well-executed movie. It's so long. It doesn't make sense. Like, I
the geography of the first chase sequence when they leave the house is atrocious. Like, yeah. How the car just automatically comes out of fields and is onto, like, a busy highway and then into that... Oh, my God.
And they're like, we're driving
Miller.
Through the cornfield. But then
I forgot he was in this movie, and I forgot what happens to him, and I can't believe it.
I was so grossed out by that scene.
I was just like, holy shit, buzzkill. That's what I wrote.
Yeah, because... Jesus, because, like, that's the other thing. Someone talked about this today on Twitter. They said, and I'm going to forget who, but someone tweeted that they used bitch like a comma in this movie, and there's, like, a scene that's just so horrifically violent, and this is PG-13. Like, it doesn't make any sense. This should be, this like, the violence in this movie alone should make this movie rated R. There are things in this movie that I, as an adult, was like, I didn't need to see that.
I didn't feel like it was worse about that than, like, I don't know, The Dark Knight or anything. My
but
biggest
I don't
problem
think that Dark Knight should be PG-13 either. That's nonsense
to me
as well.
I'm not saying that it should be, but I'm saying if that's the standard that we're using for PG-13, which apparently it is for some fucking reason, then I don't think that this was worse than that. I kind of felt like this movie, like, it has its moments. There are some lines that are, like, kind of funny. There's some moments that are kind of funny. There are some lines that are kind
of
so
Stanley
stupid
Tucci
they're
was the
funny.
Best part of this movie.
Stanley
Tucci
is the best part of this
good.
Movie.
And I feel like if you're someone that's, like, I'm inherently excited by the idea, or, like, I'm inherently interested in watching giant CG robots fight other giant CG robots. Like, there's a lot of fight sequences, and, like, I felt like, you know, you're right, it's not perfect, but I felt like they're shot well enough that, like, if that is what gets you going, then you'll have fun with this. But if you need even the tiniest reason to give a shit about what is happening on screen, and, like, even the tiniest reason why you should be sitting there for 3 hours watching these things unfold, then you're shit out of luck.
My order goes Transformers, Transformers 1, this movie, then, what was the second? Revenge of the Fallen, and then Dark of the Moon. Because Dark of the Moon's the one that made me, like, nauseous.
I'd say 4 is my top. Dark of the Moon I'd put 2nd, because I was at least interested in that one. And then 2 and 1, I don't care. But
oh,
either one.
The one is kind of good, because it's got a little heart, and you care about the characters.
I do like the characters in 1 a little bit, but it's just, oh, man, I don't
know.
Wasn't
1 the shortest?
One is
probably.
The
shortest.
So it should probably win
side,
for that.
This one doesn't have Shia LaBeouf, which, like, I'm over him, so I'm good with that. That's something.
At this point, that's a big help.
Let's wrap this up. I think we can all agree that, like, we wouldn't recommend seeing this movie.
No.
Wait, can we just all say our favorite lines?
Yeah.
I think that is very important to this conversation.
We all took a lot of notes because the lines in this movie are amazing. I want to point out
it's probably worth noting that in the middle of my Transformers notes, there's a to-do list because my mind wandered, so I needed to make note of the things that I had to do when I get home. So that's a problem. But I also wrote down this one genius line. So at a point when Mark Wahlberg is busy hiding Optimus Prime, the evil, like, cop-like government guys...
By Titus Welliver.
...come over, and the leader of them all, he goes, he's searching all of his shit, and Mark Wahlberg turns to him, and he's like, "You can't search my house without a warrant," and he goes... My face is my warrant. But, like, no, that really happened. Word for word, that happened in this movie.
I'm going to pick another one of his lines, which is, "Oh, do I look like I'm in the mood to take your shit today?" I like that one.
All right.
I can't even decide. Sadly, I think I told you this before the show. My favorite line is one that I did not write down, so I don't know word for word. But basically, it's Optimus Prime. Is it spoilery?
Oh, I have this one. This is, I don't think so.
So this is when Optimus Prime is talking, you know, because he comes from space. So he's talking to Mark Wahlberg about this. And he says, Christy, do you have the line?
I have it written down.
"Whenever you look to the stars... look at one of them and think of it as my soul."
And I love that line because it sounds like it's something out of Winter's Tale, which, as we've discussed, is our favorite terrible movie. And I was just like, I'm pretty sure that is something that, like, Downton Abbey says to Colin Farrell in that movie.
I would totally watch a Winter's Tale Transformers crossover movie.
Oh, my God.
Someone please fanfiction this immediately.
I was going to say, or someone cut together some sort of mashup trailer.
Oh, yeah. Guys, we would love you all the time if someone does that. I want to point
that
out...
note, we should probably get going.
Winter's Tale did come out on Blu-ray and DVD on Tuesday, and good what also know. Came out on Tuesday was we became iTunes worthy. So we are now on iTunes, and guys... It's just, we are bonded to Winter's Tale for life.
Yeah, that was our first episode, and now it's like the episode that it comes out on Blu-ray just as we hit iTunes. I love it.
It's a very
so, you know,
moment.
Subscribe. We have a video cast version of the podcast and an audio version, so you can subscribe to either and, like, keep up with us every week.
All right, so now you have to keep up with us on YouTube, Popcorn Prosecco, Twitter, Popcorn Prosecco, PopcornProsecco.com, and then go on iTunes, check us out there, and also be sure to give us a rating, submit a comment, because we really want to know what you think, and also ratings do help big time, and it would mean the world to us. Thank you guys so much for watching today. Before we wrap up, and before I forget, let's quickly shout out our contact info. Christy, do you want to take it first?
Yeah, I'm at Christy Puchko on Twitter. I have for Cinema Blend and the Mary Sue, and check with me every Friday on the Mary Sue, where I'll be recapping Dominion.
Angie?
You can find me on Twitter at AJHAN, and I write for slashfilm.com.
My writing is all over the place, but you can find it in one nice little spot, littlemisscritical.com, and I'm also on Twitter. My handle is PNemiroff. Thank you, as always, for watching. We love spending this time with you. And come back next week. We have some good stuff coming up.
I think we just found a Transformer.